Hello and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly podcast, the sibling podcast to the award-winning Classic Car Weekly title. I'm the staff writer, Jesse Billington, and this week I'm joined by co-hosts Chris Hope and James Sadlier. Gentlemen, how are we? And how are the cars? I know it's a bit of a quiet time at the moment.
You first. Greetings, everyone. And yeah, over to you, Chris. You go first.
I was going to let you go because, once again, the Mini hasn't really turned a wheel. It's sat in the garage. It needs a service. I can't believe we're in the middle of February. You know, spring officially is only a couple of weeks away. I didn't want to be in this place. I wanted it to have been sort of fresh oil, fresh filters, a quick check over. Just I wanted to get all of those bits and pieces done, and for various reasons just not happened. So yeah, I was trying to keep quiet and duck away, but yeah, I'm guessing you got more to write about, more to talk about, James.
Yeah, well, I my hand is forced, as you both know, by the fact that the Bred Van Polo is my only car now. But I absolutely love driving it. I really do. Every time I think to myself, right, I want to buy something that I've always wanted. I love driving it. I've got to take it back to the garage because they reattached the exhaust, which is staying on fine, but there's definitely metal against metal in a bit of a rattle going on still. And that's worsened since last week's podcast. So I haven't got around to phoning the garage yet and booking it in because I know that as soon as I do, I'll be without a car, and I've needed it lately. So that's the only thing that really needs sorting. I have found a breaker's yard that has got interior seats that look a lot less frayed than my driver's seat, and same with the my door card as well. So that's something I'd like to do. I'm probably gonna have to do the whole lot so it all matches, though, but so be it if it makes the interior look good. And I went to the festival of the Unexceptional last year, run by Haggerty, and I saw a couple of Bred Van Polos there, and they weren't in the concourse, they were visitor cars, but they were in such good condition. And I felt like I was kind of letting down the Bred Van Polo crowd by bringing my slightly shabbier version, should we say, version to the show. So I need to step it up this year's Festival of the Unexceptional.
Very nice. I mean, it's been another relatively quiet week for me as well. I haven't. I was in the workshop last night, finally getting the heater matrix out of the chimney, and reassuringly, I have actually found the point where it was leaking from. It was the water in pipe point, sort of where it joins the actual metal pipework into the actual matrix. So I'm sort of questioning whether or not that's actually fixable to save me spending sort of many hundreds of pounds on a small heater matrix. But I did phone Suzuki during the week and asked for some fresh lines and clips, and they are reassuringly expensive, annoyingly. A matrix direct from Suzuki would be £459.42, whereas lines, they've cost me £27.32 and £22.09, and then £4.82 per line clip. So
they're probably making them from scratch. Either that, or it's the research it takes to sort of find the one sort of garage that actually has one left.
Yeah, they've all got to come from Europe, so I assume Suzuki keeps all their spares in sort of a big sort of warehouse of sort of spares over there. Sort of think of, was it Ark of the Covenant, sort of that giant warehouse they stash everything in at the end of the first Indiana Jones film. Somewhere in there are the heater hoses for a Suzuki chimney, and they've had to send one man in to go and find them.
Yeah, so might see in 2 weeks.
Yes, yeah, they did say it could take about a week to go and find them and get them to the UK. We'll see what happens.
It won't be computerized either. It'll be him with his clipboard being like, section 39A. Oh, Christ, yeah.
There'll be a man in a brown store coat that's sort of got to go and find them. Yeah, we'll see. It does mean that that job is finally progressing. I phoned up the workshop that's got the midget engine in as well.
Yes.
And they have annoyingly all had COVID for the past sort of week or so. So no one's been in. Even the one fella that was bold enough to answer the phone sounded incredibly raspy and ill. So I felt quite bad for disturbing him. So, unfortunately, they've had no one in, and therefore work has been slow, if not non-existent.
Remind us what the deadline you're working to is?
Drive it day, which is checks notes.
April
sometime. It is April the 27th, which is 74 days away.
That's quite a long time. You got plenty.
You say quite a long time, but there's a lot of weekends between now and then that I'm not actually at home. I'm away at events, I'm off doing things, or I'm simply going and seeing my girlfriend, who feels rather eschewed for my cars at the moment. So there's a lot of things that are in the way of getting that MG rebuilt. And annoyingly, budget dictates that there's not really any other jobs I can do in the meantime. I can't really start on the bodywork. I don't want to start pulling apart the front suspension because all the money's got to go into getting the engine back going. Everything else is fine and functional. I just need to put the engine back together. But with the head, crankshaft, flywheel and block all over at the machine shop, there's nothing I can really start putting together yet. So yeah, just a painful case of waiting. But anyway, we'll dive into the meat of this week's podcast, and it's a bumper issue week as well, and we're looking at the future of the classic car hobby. In this week's issue, we've laid out some predictions and presented them to Fuzz Townsend to pick apart, and I'll kick off by saying I really like Mike's prediction, actually, and it's one that I feel is ringing really nice and true amongst classic fans my age. We're sort of bored of the humdrum electric blob and starting to, even if it's as a second car, buy something that's a bit older and a bit more different. I don't know if you've got any sort of other predictions that weren't yours that stand out, or any additional predictions.
Well, we'll start with yours. I mean, I think you are right. I think the likes of the 50s and 60s sort of cars that you allude to, they are coming down in price. They are becoming more affordable. And yeah, the experience that they provide is so different from a modern car that if it is something that you enjoy, these are still sort of practical cars that you can use on a regular basis. Fuel economy isn't terrible, and just the general sort of, you know, Meccano like runnings of them means that you can, if you with a decent bag of tools in the boot and the right spares, fix most things that might go wrong to get yourself going again, sort of thing. So it's like anything else. It's a lived experience, isn't it, sort of thing. You have to go all in on this. You have to be prepared for things to go wrong. But I'm increasingly finding people that I speak to that they're willing to sort of do that, just because the upside of having something that's so enjoyable to drive, you know, just sort of, you know, like imagine like a Morris Minor Tourer over the summer months, sort of thing, you know, taking the back roads rather than using motorways to get to work. It has an appeal, doesn't it? So
yeah, to my mind, those cars coming down in price, 50s and 60s cars, that people are enjoying them more because they are coming down in price, because there's less people around who remember them from their childhood, so they're less in demand. We've already seen that with pre-war cars.
Yeah.
Pre-war cars are coming down, and that was my kind of, it wasn't my prediction in this week's Classic Car Weekly, but a prediction of mine is that there'll be, in 10 years time, there'll be even less people wanting to buy, I think, 40s and 50s, 30s and 40s cars, pre-war cars, and maybe now 50s and 60s, you know, because a lot of our parents and, you know, kind of, and us as well, will be remembering the cars from the 80s, 90s and noughties. So it's just that generational thing, isn't it? So I think maybe that's it. Maybe them coming down in price will, and have there being less of a demand for them, will make them more available to the next generation. So there's a positive to take from that.
Yeah, the sort of growing wave of the cars appearing on the market and appearing at sort of reasonable prices for young enthusiasts does sort of make it that encouraging thing. I mean, there's some other interesting sort of predictions on there. Chris, your one for the extreme weather is an interesting one, especially because the picture you used to illustrate it is of Race Retro, which I should be off to next weekend if the weather's good. But it's one of those things, sort of, we're sat here on a dreary sort of Wednesday and in February, and outside it's sort of a perma grey colour and incredibly cold. And you ask, you have to sort of question whether or not sort of we're going to have to see more events make these unique planning choices. Fuzz speaks about having sort of plan Bs in place, and I think that's a wise thing that will probably become far more common.
Well, when we sort of originally came up with this article, it was what was it? It was towards the end of last year, beginning of next, sort of thing. So fresh in my mind was that the New Year gathering at Brooklands Museum had been cancelled, Classic Stonia had been cancelled, sort of thing. And that was down to snow, if I recall rightly, sort of thing, rather than rain or anything like that. It was various storms that have been, they all seem to sort of merge into one, don't they? So. But I sort of looked at it the other way. I with, you know, rising temperatures, particularly over summer months. I think the event organisers are going to have some sort of provision for dealing with extreme heat. If you are sort of thinking about events like that are based on traditionally sort of airfields converted into circuits for racing sort of thing, it's very exposed. There's very few places you can sort of hide from these areas sort of thing. So, you know, advising sort of sun cream and lots of water is one thing, but at what point does it tip over to becoming the event organizer's responsibility for making sure that people are looked after and then they're not going to be sort of, you know, there's not going to be a threat to life in that sort of sense. You know, it's, as I say, you mentioned about, you know, Fuzz and his plan Bs, and I think that's exactly right. We don't stop doing what we're doing. But I do think it's those that have that sort of risk assessment sort of mentality, those who sort of think about how they can approach these events flexibly, are going to be the real winners here sort of thing. If you're locked into a date and there's nothing you can do where things to go wrong, then that's obviously a lot of potential capital and money to lose, isn't it?
It seems to be a lot less, in my mind, indoor shows compared to, say, 5-10 years ago. I mean, I remember there was Event City up in Manchester used to do an annual show, and they just stopped that one day. And I think some of that's probably got to do with maybe outdoor land is probably cheaper to hire than maybe an indoor arena. I don't know. I'm not too sure. But you're all right about the weather, Chris, because, you know, like last summer, I mean, you're talking about the heat and being, you know, kind of looking out for the safety of people who maybe haven't taken a bottle of water with them or whatever. But last summer was just, it was a washout, wasn't it? I mean, Jesse and I were at Silverstone Classic, and it makes for a good race day, you know, watching the cars in the wet. But when you're trudging through in wet jeans, and I remember David Simister, our editor, coming back from, and he said he went out to go and speak to some car clubs, and he said there was no one around. The car clubs were there, but everyone was hiding under a gazebo. Yeah. And it's just, it just takes away from it, doesn't it? And British weather's a tough one, isn't it? But I just wish that there were more indoor shows with maybe the additional outside kind of outside arena maybe to support it. So you had the best of both.
But it's the seasonal thinking, isn't it? When you sort of think of the big indoor shows, it's the Practical Classics Classic Car and Restoration Show in March, and then it's the Lancaster Insurance Classic Motor Show in November. I don't know. I don't know whether there would be a demand for sort of an indoor event held over spring, summer months sort of thing. I think it is that time of year where people want to be out and about. I mean, obviously, there was the London Classic Car Show that maybe stands out as an event that was sort of, you know, sort of spring sort of time. And that was at the Excel, and then various other events, various other locations that looking to find a home for this year. We're not sure whether that's an event that's going to take place sort of thing. So, yeah, I think it's very tough. I think you are right. I think if I was to guess, it is more expensive to hire an indoor space than it is to hire an outdoor one. So, but it depends what you're looking for. It depends what sort of event you're putting on. So if you look at the various sort of breakfast events that have sprung up at various sort of museums and sort of motoring themed cafes such as Caffeine and Machine, they do the best of both worlds. They have that outdoor parking space and they have the indoor space. I mean, look at the success that Withall's enjoyed, the Withall Transport Museum, and things like the British Motor Museum as well. Massive car park, and you can go inside and look at things as well. Yeah, exactly.
This is always great because I feel like, you know, they've got some places to escape from the rain there as well if it did pour down. But one of the other things I was thinking about was how the Classic would look in, like, say, kind of 10 years time. And I liked it. It's always what I like to imagine as well. I like to imagine that there'll be a next generation of specialists and more jobs for the, you know, younger people as they try and, you know, get them into our hobby. Because, you know, with all of the, it's going to get to a point where our current expertise we got out there, you know, people are going to want to retire and finish up, but they also want to pass on their trade to their skills to the next generation and get them as excited about classics. But I think that might also come with the fact that people remember cars from their youth as well. So I can see cars from the early noughties coming more to the fore.
Yeah, as we see the generational shift in the cars that we appreciate as classics will also be sort of the driver for that next generation. But you mentioned the skills thing, and that's an interesting one. I think I was reading earlier this week about the JCB apprenticeships, and they've got, I think it's their first female sort of welder and sort of actual big metal worker sort of going through that process. And there is this next generation coming through. And the thing with the JCB apprenticeship is, while they would like you to go on and start working sort of on the factory floor, making diggers and stuff at JCB, a lot of other industries do recognize the apprenticeship that you go through because of the sort of kudos that that company carries. And people are regularly hired from that apprenticeship scheme into automotive, into plant manufacturing, into a variety of other things. It's not just things like sort of welding and metalwork. It's technical drawing, it's electrics, it's hydraulics, it's sort of all the engineering that goes to it as well. You learn an incredible amount from it, from what I've seemed to have read. And the net result is that this generation is coming through that has this sort of interest in mechanical skills, or what we'd see as sort of more traditional sort of hands-on technical roles. And that is a positive sign. And eventually that will trickle out to automotive and to niche automotive and to classic automotive. And I think there is a great sort of argument that things like Formula One, I say that being quite sort of biased towards it as I enjoy it as a sport, are a great driver for it. It's encouraging more people into the world of motorsport, cars, and also the engineering that goes with it. Haas have not long just appointed their first female race director. We've seen the likes of Formula One Academy bringing through great talent when it comes to not just drivers, but engineers. These new younger generations are coming through, and they're coming from different pathways as well. I think it's important that while we sort of look at classic cars and we sort of look at the more traditional routes into it, there is sort of an argument to say we should be looking at sort of other routes into the classic car world as well, and sort of encouraging more people from them, as well as simply going, you should probably go do an apprenticeship with this, or sort of pick up a job working at this sort of firm doing this. Look at, there is other ways of getting into the classic car world and getting that sort of practical hands-on experience that's going to be crucial to supporting it. But I think there's a great moment that Fuzz mentioned somewhere, and again the predictions bit, is the idea that, and I've long sort of sat on this as an interesting sort of very divisive idea, that the classic car, or the car itself, will go the way of the horse. It will become sort of a sort of enthusiast toy, but at the same time you look at how thriving the sort of world of the horse is. They have sort of huge shows across the country and events where they're sort of celebrated and enjoyed. There's the classic car hobby is very much already there, while the horses have the horse show Olympia, classic cars have the NEC. There's sort of a lot of parallels that can be drawn, and I think that while I'm not saying we exactly follow suit, there is certainly something to be said in taking notes from how they've sort of crossed hurdles and keeping people sort of enthused and enthralled by their hobby.
It'd be disappointing if it does come to a point in, you know, 25, 50 years time where the only way that we can use classic cars as we know them today, you know, the cars that are sort of established classics from sort of the 60s, 70s and 80s, the only way that we can enjoy them is sort of putting them on the back of trailers and driving them to sort of purpose-built sites that are maybe sort of themed around the 50s, 60s and 70s and driving around sort of, you know, a yesteryear sort of world that's, you know, private roads and things like that, before then putting on the trailer and driving home. And I'd be quite disappointed if that's that sort of the scenario that plays out. I don't think that's quite what you're alluding to, though.
No, I'm not saying we horse box classics everywhere, but what the fact is, they've become sort of a toy feels too much of a derogatory phrase for the car, but sort of a unique hobby that sort of is still enjoyed
the
despite
away
being
from
practically dated.
Regular use to hobby use only sort of thing. And I mean, obviously there's various examples of that already, you know, hill climbing, racing, you know, even sort of, you know, some sort of regularity trials involve cars that just arrive on trailers and then are used for that specific purpose sort of thing. So I mean, I very much like to see a world where obviously that is all still entertained, but you can still, if you want to, persevere and use a car every day, a classic car every day. Obviously it's quite a sort of a view that's maybe sort of rose-tinted when you look at the fact that there's various sort of surveys that the FBHVC, Federation of British Historic Vehicle Clubs, have put out that suggest, you know, regularly that it's around 1,000 miles a year that the average enthusiast does in a classic car sort of thing. So, you know, that's a couple of months use perhaps for a more sort of what you would call a daily. But no, as and when I want to use a classic car, I want to be able to do that. I don't want to have to sort of jump through too many hoops.
Mm. I think there'll be a balance point. I think, again, the fact that I think there'll still be a case for using classics on the road in the same way that we do. But I just think that the way that the hobby will be viewed will be more aligned with sort of other antiquated, again, sounds like the wrong phrase, hobbies or sort of means of transport. I would wonder if it'd be practical to sort of apply the, oh, I daily my classic argument for horses. And I don't know how many miles a horse comes in a year. I don't know where. Practical Horse Monthly might have an answer as to whether or not there is,
if you look at,
sort of a number to that.
You can comment, I don't know, you can't really compare this to steam trains that much because there's not as much, there are more roads than there are tracks. But you look at the love of people getting on an old train, a steam train. They won't. Most of us won't have remembered where a steam train was the main form of rail transportation, but we absolutely still love it, and we get kind of, it's a romantic, it's such a lovely thing to do. And I think that same love will be with classic cars, even if you don't remember them from your youth, and you'll still want the chance to drive one from a different era. I mean, God, if someone, I obviously don't remember the turn of the last century, but if someone gave me the opportunity to sit in a kind of a veteran car and from back in 1901 or whatever, I'd absolutely love that. That'd be fantastic. I'd wrap up warm, obviously, because most of the time when the London to Brighton is, it's the coldest part of the year, but maybe a warmer part of the year.
There's definitely an argument for the
there is a summer event now, isn't there?
They do the summer runs, yes. Yeah, the veteran car club does do a summer run as well, which is sort of usually somewhere around sort of the Surrey area. Yeah. Similar sort of distance, but far, usually finer weather. But yeah, I mean,
so if you're going to be a softie like James, you can do it, and the rest of us can do the regular.
But it's Mr. Simister. He only sends me to the winter one. Honestly, he saves the summer one for his, you know, for his shorts and his hanky on the head and everything. And
yeah, but there is something.
Jess is
going
to tell me off because I'm guessing he wants to move on. But I actually really want to talk about sustainable fuel before we do as well. James, that's your prediction. But I know that Jesse, you've got a fair bit of experience with it as well.
Yeah, no, I was going to say there's something for the emotional side of sort of cars living on as well. And like you said about sort of steam trains, I mean, I'm not a huge steam train enthusiast, but I will go out and sort of clamber along the sort of train station platform when I know one's coming through on the main line.
Yeah.
Just to see it and for the emotional experience. And yeah, there is definitely something that the public will still support, something that is incredibly outdated. I think the UK is fortunate and then we have a very nostalgic public. And yes, one that loves to revel in its history. But yeah, keeping that history sort of moving and fueled, sustainable fuels is an important one. And yeah, we've obviously got one of the predictions about it. And there is a feature in sort of our bumper issue that covers how Goodwood and their revival, their members meetings, have made a shift to sustainable fuels. And it is quite interesting. I sort of got some great feedback from Matt Hearn, the head of event content for the Goodwood's Motorsports events, and as well as sort of some great facts from Anders Hildebrand, the owner of Anglo-American Oil Company, who supplied a lot of fuel to the revival in 2024. And yeah, just sort of the shift they've made, the engineering, the people they've sort of spoken to, the car preparers, the efforts that went into making sure that this could be pulled off in a way that didn't sort of noticeably impact the event or the way that cars are run. And it sort of hints at this thing that, yeah, these cars will still be able to, even when sort of should a zero EV mandate or something be brought in, we still have this opportunity to eco-consciously keep these cars running. And it's a positive stance to take, I think.
Is it worth explaining what sustainable fuel is? Because it's probably a bit of a difficult one to sort of just sort of imagine, that idea that you're using fuel that doesn't have a carbon penalty.
It's a fuel, I think, best described as having a reduced carbon penalty or carbon impact than conventional pump fuels. So typically, when we're talking about sustainable fuels, we're talking about fuels that have used carbon from waste or reclaimed sources. So in the case of Anglo American Oils, they typically use carbon from sort of waste food product or waste forestry product. So they'll be extracting carbon from that, combining it with atmospheric oxygen and hydrogen to usually to create essentially the hydrocarbon that makes up petrol.
Yeah.
And then that's usually stabilized with a few natural compounds, usually has the ethanol balanced out, and then boom, you've got petrol. Petrol is essentially just a string of carbons with hydrogen attached to it, in the same way that most sort of ethanols are. And yeah, the net result is they can essentially chemically produce petrol from leftover compounds or freely available stuff. The point is that they're not digging up new fossil fuels. They're using carbon that already exists. And I think the ultimate way of producing a purely zero emissions fuel would be using reclaimed carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. That is a relatively sort of low production sort of scale at the moment. It is tricky to do, it is very expensive to do and takes a lot of energy to do, so they've sort of gone for the second best option, which is using otherwise waste product. So while it's not exactly atmospheric carbon neutral, there is still sort of a balance to it, and it is working, and we're seeing this sort of shift.
I feel like it's just going to come down to availability and price at the moment, because those are the two big stinging points at the moment. It's great that it's out there. It's brilliant. And I hope it becomes more readily available. But with availability, you have to have a reasonable price for people to be able to want to do it. I mean, people want to do it, but can they do it and, you know, have it not break the bank balance? So that's something that probably needs to change over the next few years.
Yeah, somewhere north of £4.50 a litre, sustainable fuel isn't exactly cheap. But the problem is it's not cheap because they aren't making it on a big enough scale. The problem is they're not making it on a big enough scale because no one wants to buy it, and no one wants to buy it because it's over £4.50 a litre. So it's sort of one of those
chicken and egg situation.
Which, who breaks first in this strange stalemate of price versus demand? There needs to be a big enough industry.
I'm not going to marginalise £4.50 a litre. That's over twice. Well, what is the current price at the pumps? It's about £1.50
£1.40 for me.
So, for the sake of argument, it's three times as much. I would suggest that if you are able to sort of afford that, particularly if you're using it specifically for an event, you can say, you know, I used my fuel, I sourced sustainable fuel for this particular event, you know, I minimized the impact of the hobby. Again, just going back to that sort of 1,000 miles a year sort of idea, it's harsh, it's particularly if your car isn't especially economical sort of thing. But if people want to do something, they can do something just to sort of say that they're, you know, living sustainably and enjoying the hobby sustainably. But yeah, and then hopefully you can sort of see that upscale from there. So because you don't have to go to specific venues, specific locations, you can potentially have it sort of delivered to you, can't you?
Yes, yeah, a variety of the different fuel producers will sort of ship you a barrel and a small pump, and it is safe to sort of store in the same way that you'd keep a jerry can of fuel in the back of the garage. Obviously, cool conditions, so you're not sort of getting it hot and pressurized in a sort of a shed set over summer. But yeah, you can get sort of a barrel of I don't know if Aramco is doing their stuff, but I know that you can get Coriton stuff by the barrel and then sort of pump it out yourself into your car and away you go.
Coriton's the supplier that's based at Vista Heritage, is that right?
They're the ones that you can get from the pump at Vista Heritage, yes. But there are a few more emerging onto the market. And again, it's not like sustainable fuels are a new thing. One of the great points that Anders makes when I had the conversation with him was that people are already using essentially a diluted version of this. When you buy your E5, your E10, your B7 petrols and diesels, what you're buying is a percentage weight of sustainable compound that's gone into that fuel. So that's typically for the ethanol content, but you can now sort of essentially get that sort of chain longer and without the OH molecule to it, which makes it the ethanol as opposed to your sort of petrols. So we're using it already in society. We're sort of essentially en masse testing the theory. And I think over time, we will see that sort of percentage compound creep up. And Goodwood and Racing have proved that you can sort of run these cars with no major problems on it. Again, with a bit of effort and with a bit of communication between engine builders, car preparers, Anglo-American Oil were able to sort of go, okay, so if you want a fuel that does a bit more this, if you want it that has this style of pre-ignition, if you want it that has sort of this temperature, this burn pattern, we can sort of factor that in with the additional compounds we add in. It does mean that, weirdly enough, they have started adding lead to some of their products again. Mostly to help try and control temperature and fuel burn style, not necessarily for sort of seats, but yeah, it just stops that sort of knocking and sort of things. But it is, again, one of those things they're having to sort of adapt as a science, and they're obviously looking at sort of how do we mitigate using heavy metal compounds when it goes into the production series. There's a lot of questions they're asking. This is still very much a sort of cutting edge and fast changing science, but it is one of those fascinating things I found out at the revival was a case of, oddly enough, while we've moved forward to something that is better carbon wise, we've reintroduced leaded fuels. So it's a very strange and interesting science, but there we go.
I remember the days when it was, you could get unleaded and that was the new thing on the block. And it was, you either had unleaded or 4-star. Do you remember 4-star petrol?
Vaguely.
I'm showing my age now. It used to be like, my granddad would say, yeah, use 4-star. I don't really trust that unleaded stuff right now.
But we saw people with the saying that same thing where we moved to like the E5 and E10 petrol. People going, I don't trust that E10. And again, I think it's just one of those things that will just change over time as a piece of acceptance. And as we move new technology into cars, as we get new events coming on and that sort of broader conversation around how we use our cars and how we sort of more sustainably and sort of consciously use our cars, it's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah. Love to talk about this more, but we really should move on now.
We should move on.
Do let us know if you want to know more about this. I think it's a really interesting subject. I'd be keen to talk about it more. So do let us know.
I will say, sort of going back through sort of the bits we've put together for this bumper issue, all the sort of the front loading of the paper this week has been phenomenal. Like the elements we've got into it, really tricky to sort of pick out which bits we do want to talk about. So we'll shuffle on into sort of the news section, and the sort of big headline news is that the Top Gear cars from Bewley Motor Museum have been saved. So many of them have been saved. They've been sort of moving on to new homes. Obviously, won't dive too far into the actual story. We'll leave you to read about that in the paper itself. But I did want to put to you guys, if you could save or have any car from the sort of Top Gear challenge build race history, what would you go for? And sort of why-ish.
I originally liked the look, because the big image on the news page in Classic Car Weekly this week is the XJS on rails, and I love that. It kind of got that Back to the Future thing with the DeLorean on rails, and I thought I could have some rails in the back garden, and I could invite people over, sit in the car, and I could push them backwards and forwards on the rails. But no, I think that's a bit extravagant. But for me, I would go for realistically the electric Subaru Brat, and it looks awesome. I had a Subaru Brat as a youngster, well, not my parents did, and I loved the car, and this one's got that lovely blue finish with the Subaru logos all over it, and it looks very cool. That's the one I'd go for.
It was sort of done a faux Colin McRae style, wasn't it? The sort of triple five style, sort of blue and gold, wasn't it? Yeah.
And I could see myself using that daily as well. Absolutely. It's a bit of a head turner as well. Everyone would be like, hang on a second. At the corner of your eye, is that an Impreza? Yeah. Oh, no, it's a pickup.
I do love that this is yet another edition of the podcast where you've shoehorned in the Subaru Brat or a similar small pickup truck.
I had to get it in one more time. Absolutely. And you look at it at the corner of your eye and you think, oh, hang on, is that an Impreza? Oh, no, it's a pickup. And also, why is it quiet?
No. Chris, what would you go for if you're saving something from the museum, or if you're just sort of delving into the enormous back catalogue of sort of Top Gear cars and sort of picking something that you would like to own?
The first thing that jumped to mind was the Citroen Ami, so from the Classic Car Rally. I think I just really enjoyed that episode. They went to Anglia Car Auctions, the three of them, and bought three sort of very different cars sort of thing. So, I like the idea of an Ami. I think that would work quite well. I think it should just about fit in the garage, and it yeah has again has that practicality while still sort of that sort of like I really like the look of them as well. So they're really quite sort of cutesy cars. So the other one that where I thought sort of slightly outside the box is maybe go for the Fiat Panda limo, because if it fits in the garage, that means I therefore have a garage that's big enough to fit the Fiat Panda limo in it. So I'm not so fussed about the car itself, but the space that I would gain from the garage.
I mean, endlessly practical as well. There's so much space inside it for sort of friends and family, just sort of down its entire something ridiculous, like 24 foot length or ridiculous, whatever it was. But yeah, a bit impractical for driving in and around sort of Peterborough in the Midlands.
Yeah, I know your streets, Chris. It's those tight little corners in Stamford. There's, you won't be able to get that out onto, your, onto the road. You'd have to cross over the grass verge and just hope it stays together.
Hope that sort of the breakover point down its length is just about enough to clear any curbs. I thought actually,
because Chris and I sometimes do Rutland Park Run, which is right next to a massive reservoir. There was another car, I can't remember which one, it had a massive sail on it, and I saw Chris and I arriving at Park
Run. You're thinking the Herald, aren't you? You're thinking
the Herald. So. I mean, we could do Park Run and then drive to Park Run in it and then go for a quick sail. I mean, it's a winner in...
Bit efficient, just,
Have either of you got a skipper's license?
Don't need that nonsense, do we? if any skippers listening now, I do apologise.
Yeah.
Anyway,
upset the sailing community that reads Classic Car Weekly. If I was going to pick something from the museum archive, it would have to be the indestructible Toyota Hilux. I think for me, that was always stood out as an episode and a segment that was just sort of like the stupidity that always appealed to like the young boy in me. And I do still love that body shape of Hilux, and I would love to have one that was absolutely mint. I know it was one, I think it won the Festival of the Unexceptional Concourse last year, and again it sort of reminded me sort of that both in absolutely shabby and absolutely perfect spec, it's just such a, I don't know, quite a fun car. But if I had to go for any Top Gear car, go for James's Mercedes Cosworth 190E from the track day car that is good in the real world. It was such a fun little weird episode, included the E36 M3 and a Sierra SAF Cosworth. Broadcast in 2010, James brought his for £2,990. If you factor in inflation, that's essentially £4,539 in today's money. Iconic had one in their NEC auction with an estimate of 30,000 to 40,000 last year, while Brightwell saw one away for 14.5. A good one went through ACO as well for just under 26 grand. So
still cheaper than a Cosy.
Still cheaper than a Cosy, and it's still a Cosworth. It's just not the Cosworth.
So
that's the one that I absolutely love, and sort of I regret not owning at the time. Mind you, at the time when that episode aired was July 2010, I would have been 12. So we're not really in the position to buy a 190E Cosworth, but there we go. Yeah.
Are you having to go at your dad for not squirreling one away for you?
Yes. There is a lot of cars that I've made exactly that argument for. 1990s Minis, 190 Cosworths. Pretty much as soon as you saw one appear on Top Gear, you should have bought it, sat on it for 8 years, and then sold it.
Yep.
Is sort of the rule
put
of thumb.
Put it in a carcoon. What are you doing?
Yeah. We've got a lot of space we could have put a lot of Top Gear cars into and then simply sold it 8 years later and reaped a lot of benefits. But there we go. Anyway, we're recording this on the 12th of February. It is that time of year. So we'll move into our final little lighthearted segment, and I'm looking for, I set you the challenge of writing some Valentine's Day classic car puns. I don't know which what you've come back with and whether or not any of them are truly broadcastable. So Chris, I know you've done your homework and got a few.
I've got a few, but go on then, Chris. How upset everyone's going to be by these, I'm not sure. You're going to have a Jaguar on the sports car on the front of the first one. You're going to open it and it's going to say, "You're my E-type." Then we're going to have an MGB on the front cover. It's going to be, "Let's MGB together." I'm starting okay. It really does get worse. You're going to have a famous small Hillman on the front cover. It's going to say inside, "I'll impress you forever, my love." And then, odd car to have on the front of a card, but it's going to be a family-sized hatchback from Vauxhall. It's going to say, "My love for you is astronomical."
Oh, I like that last one. That's a good one.
I'm sorry.
I'll tell you what, as the designer amongst,
I'm not going to subject.
As the as the designer amongst the group, I think we should set up our own business here. It's a bit of a once a year business, but it's still something. But it's good. I like those.
It's very annual. We could probably branch out to Christmas cards. I'll write down this idea and we'll revisit it again in December and see if we can come up with some similarly bad puns. James, what have you come up with?
Well, mine is my Valentine's Day ones might, rather than bring a couple together, might actually accidentally separate them. They're not the... I don't know why I went down this route, but I did. But it was... I've got... Not really looking at the outside of the car, but more the inside message that you have, you know, those kind of pre-made messages that you get in cards. And I've got, if we get divorced, you can have the kids so I can keep the E-type. And I got, oh dear, that's not gone down well. I don't know how it's going to go with our audience, but you two are just like, oh no, that's terrible.
Stone faced reaction.
Oh no, if we get divorced, you can have, I thought that was funny. Okay. Okay. I got another one. I love you. I love you loads. Almost as much as my classic car. That's a favorite one. But this one's, I love you, and you deserve a pamper this weekend at a spa with the ladies. P.S. I'm going to spa later in the year to watch some historic racing.
Hey, that's the one. I like that.
That's a pretty good one. I mean, I've sort of got three jotted down in my notes. The first one is like the most obvious, you get my motor running style thing.
Yeah.
And then I sort of got a bit niche and sort of engineering-y. I sort of went, you're hotter than a thermosiphon radiator in summer. Which is
that's very niche.
And clearly that's still brilliant. Sort of thinking about Riley product. I was like, what's wrapped in leather and purrs? A Riley Monaco fabric bodied saloon, which is... incredibly niche one. I can't see it selling particularly well, but there we go. I think it's a perfect slightly daft point on which to end this week's podcast. Of course, there's plenty more content to be enjoyed in a slightly more serious tone in this week's edition of Classic Car Weekly. There's three pages of The Way We Were, all the usual news content, as well as 50 fantastic classic events for you to book going ahead this year. Oddly enough, James, I didn't actually include the Spa Historic on here, though I should have done, because it is always a fantastic event to attend, but there's plenty more choices as well as the usual news and bits and pieces shoved in, so plenty to enjoy. Otherwise, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me.
It's been a pleasure.
Love it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you. And of course, we'll be back next week with another edition of the Classic Car Weekly podcast. Checks my notes. What have we got? We've got, we're looking back at the team's first classics then and now. So delving into some fantastic history. So plenty more to enjoy in the coming weeks. Otherwise, we'll be back. Oh, yeah. And otherwise, in a week, we'll be back. Thank you very much for listening.
Cool. Thanks, guys. Bye. See you next week.
Bye.